Canada, Europe, Asia, and South America. Trying to find the most recent stamp would drive an immigration officer crazy, Tinkerbell had said, so not to worry. The old man had also given Scott an address in Munich at which, if he dropped the passport off whenever he was in Germany, one of Tinkerbell's people would update the stamps for him. Scott knew the gift had cost Herman a lot of money, and even though he originally hadn't wanted to take it, it looked now as if it was going to come in very handy. Harvath finished changing into the J. Crew clothes and put the rest of the new clothing into his rolling suitcase. The trench coat and suit he had been wearing went into the J. Crew bag, which he promptly tossed into a dumpster in an alley behind the mall. Wiping his prints off the Glock, he disassembled it and threw the pieces into three different storm drains. Now, all he had to do was make a phone call, and he would be free to go. 44. Scott Harvath, having completely taken on the persona of Hans Brauner, strolled with a certain nonchalance through the lobby of the Ritz-Carlton, towing his luggage on wheels. When he'd walked through the main entrance, he'd noticed the cab line was full of taxis. In his German-accented English, he told the bellman he did not need any help with his bag. Having stopped at the Georgetown American Express travel office to buy a stack of traveler's checks under his new persona, he was confident in not only the outward appearance of the disguise, but his ability to pull off the complete identity of the character. Harvath made his way to the payphones and, glancing at his watch, knew he would have to make this call quickly. He picked up the receiver, deposited the coins, and dialed the number.
"Lawler," said the voice that answered.
"Gary, it's Scott Harvath."
"Scott, where the hell are you?"
"Come on, Gary. You know me better than to expect an answer to that, and don't bother tracing this call. I won't be here long enough for you to get me."
"What's this all about?" asked Lawler.
"I was going to ask you the same thing. I had nothing to do with the deaths of Andre Martin and Natalie Sperando. She was a good friend. I want you to believe that. For some reason, Bill Shaw is trying to set me up."
"Bill Shaw is trying to set you up? Why would he do that?"
"I know you're trying to stall me, but I'll indulge you anyway," said Scott, looking at his watch to see how long he'd been on with Lawler. "I think he's connected to the president's kidnapping, along with Senator Snyder and maybe Rolander as well. He's trying to paint me as a conspiracy nut."
"He doesn't need to paint you as one. You painted yourself that way."
"I did? What are you talking about?"
"I heard a recording of your call to him this morning. It didn't sound like the musings of a sane person. You're really throwing around some far-fetched notions."
"Yeah, well, if I'm so far off base with my theories, why did I get hallmarked today?"
"Hallmarked? What do you mean?"
"You know, when you care enough to send the very best."
"Are you trying to tell me somebody tried to put a hit on you?"
"Twice. Once at Union Station, and then again, outside my bank on 12th Street not long after that. They must have been tracking my credit card, because I used it to pay for cabs to both locations."
"Hitmen? Tracking your cards? Scott, this is pretty serious stuff. If you come in, I promise I'll help you."
"No thanks, Gary. That's the second time I've had that offer today, and I feel a whole heck of a lot safer on my own for the time being."
"Scott, I swear I don't know anything about a hit being put out on you. That's not how we do business, and you know it. Tell me where you are, and we'll send a car for you right away. I'll put you in protective custody while we debrief you and—"
"Yeah, and then what?" "Shaw had told me he was doing the same thing with Natalie and Andre Martin, and look what happened to them."
"Scott, how well did you know Andre Martin?"
"He was a friend of Natalie's. I just met him last night. Why?"
"When was the last time you checked your bank statements?"
Harvath looked at his watch.
"You're running out of time, Gary, and you're wasting it with questions that don't make any sense."
"The Secret Service has discovered that you received several large deposits to your bank account in the past month, the most recent being the day after the president was kidnapped. The money came from an account in the Caribbean. A little digging revealed a series of shell corporations, which eventually led to Andre Martin, D.C. attorney and international finance specialist."
"What are you saying?"
"It's not what I'm saying, Scott. It's what everyone else is. The way it looks is that Andre Martin somehow used his relationship with Natalie Sperando to get to you and buy you off."
"Buy me off? What the hell for?"
"The Secret Service and the Justice Department figure you were the inside leak and helped the kidnappers in grabbing the president."
"Me? That's insane.
Is it? Look at it from their point of view. You had the means as head of the advance team, money's as good a motivation as any, and you had the opportunity.
You can't believe that I...
You were the only Secret Service agent to survive the avalanche. You then interfered with three separate crime scenes, resulting in the corruption of evidence in at least one of them. You were the last person seen with Sperando and Martin alive.
Yeah, at a bar in D.C.
No, a desk clerk at the Radisson in Alexandria said that Martin and Sperando were picked up by a Secret Service agent who identified himself with credentials as Scott Harvath and perfectly fit your description.
And my gun was found near the scene of the murders. Well, someone thought of everything, didn't they?
Scott, if you are innocent, running is not going to help your case. Let me bring you in. I swear, nothing will happen to you.
Do you believe I'm innocent, Gary?
I need to hear your side first.
I'm not coming in, not now. Somebody has gone to a lot of work to set me up, and it looks like they're hedging their bets by trying to bump me off. I'm sorry, but I think I stand a safer chance on my own right now.
Scott, I can help you, but this has got to be done by the book. You have to come in.
Sorry, Gary. No way. You're not going to hear from me for a bit, but I want to leave you something to think about. If someone could put this whole elaborate plan together to silence me, what could that same person do to keep the whereabouts of the president secret? You're barking up the wrong tree with Abu Nidal and the FRC. It's a red herring. I'm sure of it. Widen your nets. I'll be in touch.
Harvath hung up the phone, went back through the lobby, and told the doorman he was going to Union Station. Once there, he found another cab and told the driver to take him to Dulles International Airport. 45.
Yeah, this is a problem when you are a businessman, no?
Said Harvath in his German-accented English.
But it's so sweet. Your wife will be thrilled,
said the Swissair ticket agent as she checked the passport of Herr Hans Brauner.
Yeah, I hope so. I also bought her a little something special,
said Harvath, putting the women's Pamper Yourself gift basket from Crabtree and Evelyn on the counter between himself and the agent.
Do you think she will like it?
I think she will love it. You are so sweet to drop everything and rush home to be with your wife when she has the baby. Some things are more important than jobs, aren't they?
Unfortunately, my boss doesn't approve, and I am forced to use my traveler's checks to pay for the flight. I was supposed to be here for another 3 weeks, but now with the baby coming early, we do what we can do, no?
Said Harvath, as he counted out almost $6,000 in American Express traveler's checks. It was a risky proposition. He knew airlines were very wary of customers who paid in cash, especially for same-day reservations, but he could not use any of his Scott Harvath credit cards, even if he hadn't broken them all into pieces and flushed them back at the Georgetown Park Mall, because whoever was watching would be able to track him right away. At least disguised and paying cash, he would be harder to trail. Winning the ticket agent over would definitely help him. Had she or another agent been the slightest bit suspicious, they could have created a lot of trouble for him before he even got away from the desk. It had been an expensive gamble, but it looked as if it would pay off. Harvath continued to smile as the agent asked him the standard questions about who packed his bag and whether it had been out of his sight at any time. With a final glance at his passport, she thanked him, gave him his ticket, wished him and his wife good luck, and directed him toward the business class lounge, where he could wait until his flight was called. So far, he had lucked out. Harvath's German was relatively limited, and he would be extremely hard-pressed to carry on more than a brief conversation with anyone, but that wasn't a problem with the American-born Swissair agent. He knew these agents would converse with him in the language he chose to use. Swissair was a thoroughly professional outfit, and that's why he had chosen to fly with them. This airline would respect his privacy. To them, he was another harried businessman, torn between work and family, and trying to get back home to Europe. Because of Zurich's close proximity to the German border, there was no reason a German businessman returning home wouldn't choose to fly into Zurich rather than Munich, especially if time was of the essence and Swissair's was the next flight out. Harvath hadn't eaten anything since his bagel and orange juice that morning. While he could have picked something up at the mall, he hadn't wanted to waste time. He was thankful for the food in the Swiss Air lounge, and discreetly loaded up while he waited for his flight to be called. When the 5:40 flight to Zurich was called in the lounge, Harvath stood with the rest of the businessmen and made his way to the plane. A German newspaper tucked under his arm, and walking slowly, almost wearily with his bag in tow, Hans Brauner blended in with the rest of the business travelers and boarded the plane without incident. Finding his seat, he accepted an orange juice from one flight attendant as another took his coat. He felt his muscles relax as the plane pulled away from the gate and taxied out onto the runway. When the plane's engines revved up, he felt even more of the tension drain away from his body. Placing a "Do Not Wake Me for Meals" sticker on his headrest, he slipped out of his shoes, donned the Swiss Air booties and eye mask from his courtesy kit, and was asleep before the plane reached its cruising altitude. 46. Scott awoke in time for breakfast and enjoyed a vegetable omelet, croissant, fruit, and coffee. He made one last trip to the bathroom to make sure his disguise was still firmly in place, and then watched out the window as the plane made its final approach into Zurich International. As he walked along the never-ending moving sidewalks toward passport control, he grew convinced that the Swiss government was in cahoots with airport advertisers. Why else make passengers walk so far, if not to take in the endless stream of advertisements for Swiss watches, jewelry, pens, and chocolate? Finally, Harvath reached passport control. It was almost 8 o'clock in the morning local time, and in an uncharacteristically Swiss fashion, there was only one passport control agent on duty. Being in business class did have its advantages, one of which was getting off the plane with the first-class passengers before everyone else and being at the head of the line for passport control. But that wasn't the case today. Apparently, another flight had arrived just before Scott's, and there was already a good-sized line at passport control. The grumbling of tired, cranky passengers could be heard up and down the queue. He stood nervously in line for only a few minutes before another passport control officer appeared at the next booth, and the line began to move faster. Scott had decided to stay with the Hans Brauner disguise and present his German passport, just in case his real one had been flagged. As the plane was landing, he went through all of the possible questions he might be asked by the German-speaking passport control officials and how he would respond. As it turned out, he didn't need any of it. Anxious to clear the backup, the passport officer just glanced at the stamps of Hans Brauner's passport and added a new one. It was a red rectangle with the corners rounded off. It had the German word for Switzerland, Schweiz, with the date, followed by the words Zurich Flughafen. As Harvath was waved through by the officer, he said a small thanks for the good fortune that had brought Hermann the German into his life. Harvath exited through the customs nothing to declare lane. Everything had gone off without a hitch. But Harvath reminded himself not to get too comfortable. Pretending to be slightly confused, Harvath purposely walked past the departure monitors and signboards, only to turn around and come back to them, which allowed him to check whether anyone was following him. As far as he could tell, no one was. Following the overhead signs, he reached an information counter and picked up a small brochure that had a map of the airport and a list of shops and services. He found the establishment he was looking for and made his way toward the next concourse. Along the way, he counted 14 more billboards for Swiss watches, 7 for pens, 11 for jewelry, and 9 for chocolate. It was amazing. Coming upon a men's room, Harvath carefully rechecked to make sure he wasn't being followed and ducked inside. He chose a stall at the end, walked in, and locked the door. Quickly, he changed out of his earth-toned clothes and into a pair of baggy cargo pants, boots, and a t-shirt, which he covered with a retro 70s green sweater with red and brown racing stripes across the chest and down one sleeve. The false eyebrows, goatee, and glasses were all safely packed away. Scott was still wearing the brown contact lenses, and as he pulled on a blue-knit cap, he exited the men's room. To any casual observer, Scott Harvath now appeared no different from any of the other 20-something European or American youths who either lived in Switzerland or were vacationing there for its incredible skiing and snowboarding. This disguise, though, needed one final element to make it complete. Harvath covered the distance to his objective in the next terminal with the slow, lackadaisical stride he imagined his new persona would have. He found the Zoom hair salon exactly where the airport services guide said it would be and went in. As the young hairstylist worked, Scott discovered she was eager to practice her English. When he told her he was in Switzerland for the snowboarding, she launched into reviews of the different places she and her friends had been throughout Switzerland, France, and Austria. He had stumbled upon a real devotee. When she was finished, Scott paid her in the Swiss francs that he had gotten at the currency exchange in the baggage claim area before proceeding through customs. He took a final look in the mirror and gave the stylist a thumbs up. She had done a very good job. While anyone looking for Scott Harvath or Hans Brauner would be searching for men with brown hair parted on the side or in the middle, Scott now sported an extremely short haircut that had been bleached a bright blonde, bordering on white. While it wasn't the most inconspicuous hairstyle on the planet, it would suit Harvath's needs, and it was cold enough in Switzerland that he could always cover up with a hat if needed. Popping on a pair of dark blue wraparound Spy brand sunglasses, he strutted out of the hair salon and followed the signs to the airport train station. The first time Scott came to Europe had been with the U.S. freestyle ski team. He smiled as he thought about how his new clothes and hairstyle would probably make him fit right in with all the members of this year's team. Scott remembered now how impressed he had been with the European rail system. Almost all of the major airports had railway terminals, as opposed to America, where the airports were on the outskirts of town and the railroad stations were right in the center, requiring some sort of transportation in between. Reaching a schedule board near the ticket window, Scott saw that there was a train leaving soon that would get into Interlaken at 12:20. He paid the equivalent of $50 in Swiss francs and bought a second-class ticket. On the platform, he noticed a group of students and casually made his way over to them, trying to blend in. The train arrived exactly on time, and Scott boarded with them. He placed his bag, which he had converted to a backpack, on the overhead rack, and sat as close to the students as possible. The train made a couple of stops within and around Zurich, then began to pick up speed as it traveled out into the countryside. Once the conductor had passed through the car and checked on people's tickets, Scott leaned back in his seat and closed his eyes. It would take about 2.5 hours to cover the 239 kilometers between Zurich and Interlaken, and by the time he arrived, he hoped to have made some sense out of the last 4 days. Starting at the beginning, Scott replayed in his mind everything that had happened. It was obvious that whoever the kidnappers were, they had had inside help, and it involved William Shaw somehow. Shaw was working with Senator Snyder, and the two had conspired to kill Andre Martin and Natalie Sperando, then pin the murders on him. They had arranged for a person or persons to steal his gun, use it to kill Natalie and Andre, and then leave it behind so the evidence would point directly at him. Then Lawler had said there were deposits made to his bank account via a series of Caribbean shell companies that Andre Martin was somehow involved with. Shaw had admitted that Harvath had been at his house, but denied the true reason he was there, what he did, and what they discussed. So Shaw was unquestionably covering for Senator Snyder, and the two were definitely in bed together. But why? How could Shaw, a career Secret Service man, be involved with something that resulted in the deaths of so many of his own men? What was the reason? That was where it started to break down for Scott. Why would they frame him and then turn around and try to kill him? Whoever had knocked him out at his apartment could easily have finished the job as he lay unconscious on his kitchen floor. Why not kill him right then and there? Why the cat-and-mouse game? Unless framing him would take the heat off them, and he had spoiled their plans by refusing to allow himself to be captured. How was Senator Rolander connected to all this? And who or what was Stargazer? As Scott tried to make the pieces fit together, other images and fragments flooded his mind that didn't seem to have a place in the puzzle. He felt his headache increase in intensity and decided to leave alone what he didn't know for the time being and focus on what he did know and why he was here. From the outset, Harvath had never believed the kidnapping could have been conducted by Middle Easterners. Call it an ingrained bigotry he had picked up in the SEALs, or a healthy understanding of what Mideast terrorist groups were and were not capable of. But an operation of this nature, carried out in snow, just couldn't have been pulled off by any group from the Mideast. Harvath had discounted the lone body found with a scorpion as a red herring from the beginning. It bothered him that Sam Harper had managed to get a shot off, but somehow no one had ever heard it. If Middle Easterners hadn't actually pulled off the job, could they have financed it? Yes, that was a definite possibility. But Harvath had an even harder time believing that men like Bill Shaw and even Senator Snyder would sell their country out to foreigners. That didn't fit. Scott's head began to throb as his mind drifted, and he struggled to again bring it back and concentrate on what he knew. His gut told him that the people who pulled off the attack and kidnapping worked very well in snow and had a lot of experience. They had access to explosives to trigger the avalanche, money and international contacts to purchase the jammer, and came up with incredible tactical advantages that allowed them to wipe out the president's protective detail and get away, leaving almost no trace at all. Almost no trace were the key words. They had left traces at the Mormon farmhouse. There had been cigarette smoke and that piece of Swiss chocolate. He had seen mousetraps in the kitchen and in one of the bathrooms, so Harvath knew the chocolate couldn't have been there long. It had to have been dropped by whoever was watching the house, waiting for the rest of the kidnappers to return. Then there was the email from Nestle that said the chocolate was sold only in Switzerland. Had one of the kidnappers bought it on a layover on a flight from somewhere in Sandland? Not likely. It wasn't until he read the note and saw the Interlaken post office box address in the manila envelope Martin had led him to that his hunch about Switzerland began to seem like such a good possibility. As the train gently rocked back and forth along the tracks, Scott glanced out the window at the majestic snow-covered Swiss mountains. A Swiss railway magazine hung from a small hook above the seat opposite him, with a title in German and English. The Eiger, only for the foolish? Scott took down the magazine and began to skim the article. It talked about one of the country's most daunting peaks and the attempts by teams from all over the world to conquer it. As his eyes drifted from the photos in the glossy magazine to the Swiss countryside speeding past his window, he was positive his instincts were correct. Whoever arranged to kidnap the president had put together an incredible team of soldier mountaineers. Germany, France, Italy, and Austria could also boast men potentially up to the task, but it was the smattering of clues, hints, really, that narrowed Harvath's gut feeling down to Switzerland. Scott still had the same question that every law enforcement officer in America had. Cui bono? It was Latin for, who benefits? Who would benefit from kidnapping the president? The possibilities were endless. Although the communications received by Washington since the kidnapping seemed to point to the Fatah, Scott made up his mind to leave the cui bono question to the FBI and everybody back home. Right now, who benefits was not as important as who took him and where is he. Harvath had learned a long time ago to go with his gut. Everything that had happened, everything he had seen and felt, told him the men responsible for taking the president were from here. And as sure as he knew that, Scott also knew that he would bring the president back and bring him back alive, no matter how long it took to find him. 47. The hardest thing to get used to had been the smell, the god-awful smell. That and the intolerable intermittent wailing of people being called to worship over scratchy public address systems. Then there was the sand. It was everywhere. In his clothes, in his hair, even in his food. There didn't seem to be a single crack or crevice in the president's cell that the sand hadn't made its way into. He had heard that about the desert. It would eventually overtake anything, even if it took thousands of years to do it. The sand reminded him of when he and his late wife had visited Egypt and the pyramids many years ago. He wondered where in the world he was now. He knew it was someplace hot, at times unbearably hot, and very dry. The calls to worship meant that he was close to an Islamic population, maybe a town, a village, or even a city of some sort. His cell had no windows, so he had no idea if it was day or night. Only the deliveries of terrible-tasting food through a sliding grate at the bottom of the cell door interrupted his isolation. The floor was covered with straw. There was a bed with a thin mattress against one wall, and a Turkish toilet in the corner, which was nothing more than a hole in the floor with two stone footrests to stand on. At first, he thought the terrible stench was wafting up from the toilet, but gradually, he realized it was coming from outside and was being carried in by the ventilation system of his cell. He tried to memorize every detail, as he knew there would be a very extensive debriefing once he returned home. If I return home, he thought. Of course he would return home. He couldn't let himself think otherwise. He was the president of the most powerful nation on Earth. Right now in D.C., they would be doing everything they could to get him back. He knew that, and had to keep focusing on it. If the kidnappers had wanted him dead, they could have killed him already. There was no reason to keep him alive unless they intended to return him once their demands were met. To take his mind off his confinement, the president tried to think about his daughter, but that only led to more distress. He had no idea what had happened to her. The last thing he remembered was splitting up with her detail, planning to meet back at the house for hot chocolate. As he made his way down the death chute, there was some sort of accident, and he lost his vision. There were strange voices, and someone started an IV on him, and then he awoke in this cell, dressed in a cheap and uncomfortable peasant robe, bearing an Arabic logo. That was all he was really sure of. Even though there was a huge chunk of his memory missing, it wasn't hard to figure out that his detail had been ambushed, and he had been drugged, kidnapped, and then taken someplace very far away. He only hoped Amanda hadn't been harmed. He tried to convince himself that she had made it back to the house safely. Scott Harvath was on her detail, and he was one of the best. He wouldn't have let anything happen to her. She had to be all right. She was all right. Anything else was unthinkable. Losing his wife had been painful enough, but if anything happened to Amanda, he didn't know if he could go on living. For now, though, his body was weak, and he had no sense of time. His mind was strong, and he vowed to hold on. The United States would not allow its president to languish in a cell in the middle of some godforsaken desert. His salvation would come. He would be getting out, and getting out alive. This would be the only thought he would allow his mind to entertain. He had a daughter to get back to, and a country to lead. The president's interior pep talk was interrupted by the sound of the bolt sliding back from his cell door. Two large men entered, wearing desert fatigues and keffiyeh headdresses that covered their faces. One was carrying a Kalashnikov AK-47 machine gun, and the other had one hand hidden behind his back. The man with the machine gun gestured for the president to move back against the wall. Instead of moving, Rutledge rose to his full height and said, "I demand to speak with whoever's in charge here. Now!" For a moment, both of the men stood still, shocked into immobility by the outrageous insolence of their prisoner. The shock wore off quickly, though, and the guard with the machine gun covered the distance across the cell to the president in a fraction of a second. He raised the butt of his weapon and was preparing to strike Rutledge when the other man stopped him with what sounded to Rutledge like a quick stream of angry Arabic. The guard lowered his weapon. The president began to breathe a sigh of relief, which immediately caught in his throat as the other man, who had been steadily moving toward him, grabbed him by the wrist and plunged a long hypodermic needle into his arm. 48. At precisely 12:20, Scott Harbath's train pulled into Interlaken Ost's tiny station. Using the stairs in the center of the platform, he descended into the pedestrian tunnel and re-emerged two tracks over at the main station house. He fished in his pockets for the change from the soda and bag of chips he had bought from the roaming snack cart on the train, and came up with the right amount for a locker. He placed his bag inside, deposited the money, and withdrew the key. On a counter with train schedules and tourism brochures was a customer comment form that could be folded over and sealed. He took one and began writing in it.
If you're going to have a cocktail, you've got to go for it. Nothing beats a full double, full martini. I'll be at the one place in Interlaken that has a lot of soul.
Sealing the envelope, Harvath walked outside into the bright sunshine. Sitting among a cluster of backpacks, skis, and snowboards was a group of loud American kids. They were either travelers or exchange students off for a long weekend of fun in the Alps. The one thing that was for sure was that they were all heading to the most popular youth hostel in Interlaken, Balmer's.
"Hi there," said Harbath.
"Hi yourself,"
said a cute blonde girl with a nose ring. "Waiting for the Balmer's van?"
"Yeah. Lucky it's such a nice day and we can sit outside. Glad I brought my sunblock. It could be a blistering weekend if it stays this bright."
"You never know in the Alps. Listen, I was wondering if you might be able to do me a favor."
"That depends," said the girl coyly.
"Yeah, right," said Scott, smiling. "I've been split up from my friends, and I'm not sure if they're coming in on the next train or maybe got here earlier. The lady Jackie, who runs the hostel, knows us from last year. Would you mind giving this note to one of the desk staff for her when you check in?"
He handed her the sealed note.
"Sure, no problem. So, you're staying at Balmer's too?"
"Yeah, we're here doing a bit of boarding. Supposed to be some really nice fresh powder coming in."
"Well, maybe I'll see you later."
"Maybe. Thanks for delivering my note."
"My pleasure."
Scott walked back into the station and waited for the Balmer's van to pick up the Americans before heading out to the main street known as the Hoevek, where he turned right and walked toward town. Interlaken had always been one of Scott's favorite places in Europe. The name Interlaken meant between the lakes, and it was exactly that, nestled between sparkling Lake Thun and Lake Brienz. Water surrounded the town in the form of deep blue lakes, bubbling fountains, rushing rivers, thundering waterfalls, and crystal-clear streams. Harvath marveled all over again as he walked by the fin de siècle palaces that stood as a reminder of Interlaken's role as a health spa mecca in the second half of the 19th century. He passed the Hotel du Nord on his left and the Restaurant des Alpes just after on his right. The next sight to greet him was the enormous expanse of park known as the Hoheimat.
"If I'm lucky, maybe I'll be back here in the fall, sitting in the Hoheimat, sipping sekt and enjoying the jazz festival," Scott thought to himself.
At the far end of the park was the Jungfraustrasse and the Schuh Café. If Jackie was in and received his note, this was where she would meet him. The name of the café and its English equivalent were pronounced the same and meant the same thing, Schuh. Knowing Jackie, she would be quick enough to make the connection between S-O-U-L and S-O-L-E. Full double full was a very difficult aerial ski jump and was Scott's last winner before leaving the ski team. His old friend loved martinis, and since Scott had been the one to turn her on to them, he was pretty certain she'd be able to figure out who the note was from and what it meant. Scott entered the tourist information office directly across the street and pretended to read brochures as he watched the front door of the café. 20 minutes later, he saw a shock of bright red hair and a face full of freckles that could belong to only one person. Waiting first to make sure she wasn't being followed, he then pocketed the brochure he was holding about Jungfrau region tours, left the information office, and crossed the busy street to the café. Jackie Krepler had her back to him as he entered. She was scanning the room, and he sneaked up behind her, covering her eyes with his hands.
"Quick, how do you get 50 freestylers into a shoebox?" said Harvath.
"Tell them it's going to have a sponsor," squealed Jackie, who spun right around to hug him.
What are you doing here? This is amazing!
I was in the neighborhood, thought I'd drop in.
Let me look at you, she said, pushing him away from her but holding on to his forearms.
Nice hairdo.
So, you've quit government work and have gone back to the ski team?
Not exactly.
I'm sure the president just loves this hairstyle. Very understated.
Very subtle.
Is this some way of distracting attention away from him on assignments? Because I'm sure it works. And are those brown contacts you're wearing? Why would you want to go and hide those beautiful blue eyes?
The initial happiness Scott felt at seeing her was quickly fading under the weight of the real reason he had come to Interlaken.
Can we get a table?
Sure,
responded Jackie, who said something to the maitre d' in Swiss German that Scott couldn't understand. They were led to a small table against the far wall, away from the window. Jackie withdrew a pack of cigarettes and lit one.
From elite world-class athlete to smoker? Who would have guessed? Said Scott.
You try living in Europe for over 10 years married to a smoker and not get hooked.
I only have one once in a while and only when I drink.
I know, it's no excuse, but hey.
What do you want?
Said Jackie, as a waiter approached their table.
Ein großes Bier, said Scott.
Und einen Kier, bitte?
The waiter nodded politely and left. They made small talk about Interlaken and how the season was going. Then Jackie took a drag on her cigarette and launched into a rapid-fire series of questions.
Okay, enough chit-chat. I want to know everything that's going on with you. What have you been doing? I mean, who've you been dating? Why haven't I heard from you in such a long time? And most of all, how are you able to get time off during one of the biggest crises to hit the United States?
Scott saw the waiter coming back and decided to hold off on answering. The man set down their drinks, along with a bowl full of heavily salted, homemade potato chips, and left again. Jackie dug right in.
Where do you want me to start? Asked Scott.
I don't know, said Jackie between bites. Start wherever you want. What are you doing here? Vacation?
No, it's not a vacation. I'm in trouble, and I need your help.
Trouble? What do you mean, trouble?
Scott was quiet.
Does this have something to do with the president's kidnapping?
His face must have betrayed his reaction as she said,
Don't look so surprised. It's big news everywhere.
The fact that the kidnapping of the president was making headlines around the world was no surprise. What surprised him was Jackie's ability to put it all together so fast. She had always been able to read him so well. Even though they had been only kids when they dated on the ski team, Scott had thought she might be the one for him. When his father died, though, his life had been turned upside down. By the time he had gotten his act together, Jackie was deeply involved with a Swiss skier whom she would eventually marry. All that remained for the two of them was to be good friends. Even though Scott had the best of intentions, he seemed to keep falling out of touch, not only with Jackie, but with a lot of people who mattered to him. He always blamed his work for keeping him too busy, but as he looked across the table at Jackie, he realized he had only himself to blame for dropping the ball. She was even more beautiful now than during their days on the ski team. She was quite a woman, cigarettes notwithstanding.
How's the hostel doing, Jackie? Every time I'm in a bookstore, I pick up guidebooks on Switzerland, and there you are.
The Krepler family must have been real happy to gain such a shrewd manager come daughter-in-law, he said.
Let's not forget the lucky husband who got such a fabulous wife, either.
We can't forget the husband.
How is old Rolf?
The same as ever, Jackie answered, taking a sip of her Kier.
Now, quit dancing around the subject and tell me what you mean by being in trouble. Were you there when the kidnapping happened?
This has got to stay between you and me.
Of course. Who do you think you're talking to? I'm the same old Jackie. We'll make sure the tongue stays in the old shoe. My lips are sealed. Besides, you're the one who came looking for me.
She was right. Scott needed her help, although only minimally. He didn't want to get her too involved. He took a deep breath and then began his story.
Yes, I was there. I was one of the only two survivors, last I heard. Most of the agents were either buried alive in the avalanche or...
Scott hesitated.
Or what? What happened?
Or they were shot to death.
Shot to death? That's terrible.
It gets worse.
A woman I was good friends with and a friend of hers were killed Tuesday night, not long after I had drinks with them, and now I'm the number one suspect in their murder.
Jackie would never have succeeded at professional poker playing. Her face went from rapt attention to all-out shock.
Murder? You? She managed.
Yep.
And it looks like my gun, which was stolen from my apartment, was used to kill them. Also, several large deposits were coincidentally made to my bank account right around the time of their murders and the kidnapping of the president.
Are the two events connected?
In too many people's minds right now, I'm the connection. I've been framed both for the murders and for being the inside leak that helped the kidnappers take the president.
But I thought the Secret Service thought so highly of you. The few times I heard from you, it sounded like everything was so great.
It was great.
Well, what about your boss, your superiors? They know you. They should be able to vouch for what kind of person you are. Surely they know you weren't involved with any of this.
Her vote of confidence meant more to him than she would ever know.
The problem is that my immediate supervisor, who was also my very good friend, was killed in the kidnapping, and the next boss up is somehow involved in all of this on a very bad level.
Aren't there any people higher up than him?
Yes, there are. But the evidence against me is pretty overwhelming. The last I spoke with them, they invited me to come in so I could prove my innocence.
Prove your innocence? Whatever happened to innocent until proven guilty?
That's why I've always liked you, Jackie. You get right to the point. Those were my feelings, exactly.
So, you fled here to Switzerland? Are you trying to avoid extradition?
No.
Well, forgive me if I'm overstepping my bounds, but I think I know you well enough. If you are innocent, and I believe that you are, doesn't running only make it harder for you in the end?
Depends on how you look at it.
What do you mean?
You see, I know I didn't do it, and so do the people who are trying to frame me.
Okay.
Well, they seem to have changed their minds about framing me, and tried twice yesterday to kill me.
Jackie drew in a sharp breath.
Are you okay? They didn't hurt you, did they?
Scott smiled.
You know me. I'm bulletproof. They're going to have to try a lot harder than that.
They'd better not. So, what now? Do you plan on hiding out over here until things cool down? Do you need money?
No, I'm okay in the money department for now. But thanks. I have a few leads I want to follow up.
Leads? Over here?
They were getting into tricky territory, and Scott chose his words very carefully.
There are some people I need to track down and talk to who might be able to help me out. When the time is right, hopefully I'll have my ducks in a row and will be able to go home. In the meantime, nobody can know I'm here.
Well, I won't say anything.
I appreciate that. I also need to ask you a favor.
What kind of favor?
I need a place to stay.
The look on her face said it all. She really wanted to help him, but what he was asking was a major imposition. Despite the camaraderie that existed between all of the freestyle skiers, even if they were from different countries, Jackie's husband had always viewed Scott as competition, both on and off the hill. Rolf was extremely jealous of him and was not happy with the way Scott occasionally showed up for a visit or a letter from him would appear in the post. Scott's last visit had not gone well, and Jackie and Rolf had fought for over a week when he forbade her to ever see or speak to Scott again. Rolf would prefer that he was out of Jackie's life for good.
You know, you're not Rolf's favorite person.
I know, and I've felt bad about it ever since I was last here. I didn't mean to upset him.
I think it's more his problem than anything else. He's always felt threatened by you.
I don't know why. He's a good-looking guy with a beautiful wife and both a successful business and political career. He's still active in politics here, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. More than ever. Listen, like I said, the whole thing between you two was always his problem, more than anything else.
Jackie, I'm sorry to put you out. If I thought there was anywhere else I could go, I would. It's just I've got some very heavy things to work out, and I need to stay somewhere safe. I don't think anyone would come looking for me at your place. I know this is a burden, but I need your help.
Chewing on her bottom lip, she swirled the raspberry-colored liquid in her wine glass.
In one sense, you're lucky. First, I was around to get your message.
You think you're so smart. Full, double, full, full.
You don't think if Rolf had gotten that note, he wouldn't have been suspicious?
Scott grinned sheepishly.
Second, said Jackie, ignoring the cute look on Scott's face. He's in Bern for a week with his political party, so it won't be too tough to keep you hidden away.
Harvath breathed a sigh of relief as Jackie continued.
We've been rehabbing part of the Herberger for the summer. I can put you in one of the completed rooms, and no one should even notice. There's a lot of sawdust in the halls. You still have to use coins for hot showers, and there will be no maid service. But my guess is you're willing to accept the room under those conditions?
You're absolutely right. I owe you big time.
Yes, you do. Now, how do I get you the key? Wondered Jackie, as she bit down once again on her pouty strawberry pink lip. Ah, I'll leave it with a note under one of the garbage cans in the alley behind the main building. We have about 6 cans, all painted bright red. One of them is smaller than the others. I'll put it under there. All I ask is that you use the back stairs, and try not to draw any attention to yourself.
Believe me, I have no intention of doing that.
Could have fooled me with that haircut and dye job of yours.
They both laughed, and Scott reached across the table and took Jackie's soft, freckled hand. She tensed at first, and then relaxed.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate this, Jackie. I don't know who else I could have turned to.
Well, even if Rolf was in town, we would have found a way to deal with this. You and I go back a long way.
We certainly do.
I just hope you can get yourself out of this mess you're in.
I will. Don't worry.
Jackie gave his hand a squeeze and rose from the table.
I take it drinks are on you?
You bet. When can I look for the key?
The garbage was picked up this morning, so I don't think there'll be any problem if you try in about an hour. You remember the back way, round by the volleyball court?
You have the volleyball court going even in the cold?
Scott, have you forgotten the stupid stuff we used to do in the middle of winter after a couple of drinks?
Yes, he said, smiling.
Liar. Anyway, I'll have you know, winter volleyball happens to be a huge draw with our young clientele. I'll have the key there within the hour.
Jackie gave his hair a ruffle and let out a disapproving sigh.
You used to be such a handsome guy, she joked.
Thanks a bunch, Jack.
I'll see you later.
She gathered her purse and coat. Scott watched her disappear out the front door, and then reappear outside the window as she made her way up the Jungfraustrasse back to Balmer's Herberge. He finished his beer and decided to retrieve his bag at the station, then wander around town to kill some time before heading up to the hostel. 49. The key and a note were left under the smallest red garbage can, just as promised. The little map Jackie had drawn showed that his room was in the far south end of the structure, just off the main building. Despite the fact that broad daylight made it difficult not to be seen, Harvath managed to get inside and up to his floor without being noticed. As he climbed the stairs, his nose was greeted by the sweet smell of fresh lumber. The Herberge itself looked like something out of an old Heidi movie. It was a typical Swiss-style chalet, wood inside and out. Painted under all of the gables were scenes of historical Swiss daily life. Flower boxes hung from every window. Dodging assorted construction debris, Scott found his room and opened the door. Jackie had made the bed and left him several bottles of mineral water, cheese, a couple of apples, bread, a salami, an electric coffee pot with coffee, dishes, a fork, a knife, and a spoon. Next to these staples was a notepad with writing on the top sheet that read,
"By the way, none of this stuff is free. It all goes on your bill. Enjoy your stay. Jay."
She hadn't changed one single bit, and thank God for that. Scott didn't know what he would have done without her. Staying in a regular hotel would have been tricky. They would have requested he leave his passport as a deposit. As it stood now, he didn't want either of the two he carried to be out of his possession. The floor, the walls, and the gently sloping ceiling were all constructed from beautiful blonde wood. The double bed had white sheets and a red checkered comforter. There was a sink on one wall, and he figured the toilets were down the hall next to the showers he had seen. Per Jackie's suggestion, Scott had changed some of his paper money for 5-franc pieces at the Interlaken post office so he could enjoy a shower with hot water in the morning. He'd also bought a couple of envelopes and some stamps. He set the coins on the counter next to the sink. Feeling a bit warm, he opened the casement windows just a crack. They opened outward like mini French doors. In her note, Jackie had mentioned that the workmen often opened them during the day, but that he must remember to close them at night, or one of the staff might come up to investigate. He kicked off his shoes and sat down on the bed. From a blue plastic bag, he withdrew the purchase he had made at a shop just around the corner from the Herberge. When Scott had passed a gun store called the Waffenhaus Schneider, he couldn't believe his luck. Though he wasn't a Swiss citizen and couldn't purchase a real firearm, something else sat smiling out at him from the display window. Harvath entered and admired the wide range of weaponry. As he moved from section to section, he finally settled in front of a display by the window that read, "New from Tokyo, Airsoft." Airsoft products were a line of authentic-looking replica firearms that fired 6mm plastic balls. They were so realistic that they were used in Hollywood movies and by several federal and local law enforcement agencies for training. The toy guns came in revolver models, semi-automatics, machine guns, shotguns, sniper rifles, you name it, and Tokyo Marui made it. Scott had finally settled on a Glock 17. It was an almost perfect copy of the exact weapon, minus the silencer, he had used to save his life just the day before. He hoped he wouldn't need to count on a toy gun to save his life in the future, no matter how realistic it looked, but until he could get his hands on a real one, this would have to do. Sliding the cover off the box now, he removed the gun from the inner styrofoam box. It had cost him about $60 U.S., but at least now, maybe he wouldn't feel so vulnerable. In a pinch, bluffing with the fake Glock would be better than having nothing at all, but the sooner he got a hold of a real weapon, the better. Rolf undoubtedly had one of the government-issued assault rifles somewhere in their house, but the Swiss didn't issue their civilian army ammunition with their rifles. That was okay. Scott didn't want to put Jackie any further out than he already had. Besides, how the hell would he conceal an assault rifle? He continued to plug the little white balls into the magazine. To his surprise, they helped bring the weight of the pistol closer to what it would be in real life, and didn't make any rattling noise when he twisted the gun from side to side. The best part was that it would fit neatly in his waistband without being seen. Scott set it aside and reached for the pad and pencil Jackie had left on the table with the food. He tore off the top piece of paper with her handwriting and set the pad on the bed next to him. Fishing the manila envelope from Andre Martin's locker at Union Station out of his pocket, he began flipping through the papers until he found what he was looking for. The note to Aunt Jane, and the address in Interlaken. Trying to copy the senator's handwriting wouldn't be necessary. He wanted whoever read his letter to know there was a new player in the game. Putting the pencil against the pad to begin his own little note to Auntie Jane, Harvath noticed that he could see an impression of the note Jackie had written on the page before it. The realization came to him in a flash, and he felt stupid for not seeing it before. His brain really had been scrambled. It was one of the oldest tricks in the book. The reason the note to Aunt Jane, which Scott had decided beyond a shadow of a doubt came from the senator, looked like a negative on the photocopied page, was because that's essentially what it was. He had to hand it to Andre Martin. He'd been extremely thorough. Finding the senator's pad, Andre had lightly sketched with a pencil across the top page to see what had been written on the page before it. Most people wrote hard enough that their writing could be read several pages deep in a pad. Martin had known this trick and had been able to salvage the letter. It was all beginning to make sense. There was no way the senator would have engaged in his shadowy business at his office. There were too many opportunities to be found out. Instead, he worked from home, confident in his security. Based on the evidence in front of him, Harvath decided the senator was either very careless or Andre Martin was very clever. It was probably a combination of the two. Scott stuck as close as he could to the language of the note contained in the manila envelope. The key was for the reader to know someone was on to him.
Dear Aunt Jane, you have been a very bad girl. You have taken something that doesn't belong to you, and many people want it back. I have no disagreement with you, but believe my silence is worth something. Why don't we meet to discuss it? I will be at the top of Europe's Ice Palace at noon the day after you receive this. I look forward to a mutually profitable chat. Yours, a friend of Edwin's.
Scott read the letter several times before sealing it in the envelope he had bought. After addressing it with the interlocking post office box, he stamped it and left for the post office. Walking down the Centralstrasse, Harvath roamed the neighborhood and pretended to window shop until 5 minutes before the post office closed. Then, he slipped his letter into the outdoor slot, satisfied that the letter would not make it into the post office box until tomorrow morning at the earliest. He walked back to Balmer's and ran his plan through his mind yet again. It was a long shot, and he knew it, but at this point, it was the only shot he had.
50. Stargazer hurriedly grabbed the wastebasket beneath his desk and vomited. Lying on a crumpled piece of wax paper on his desk was a man's severed finger. He knew whom it belonged to and who had sent it.
I can't believe they managed to get this into my office, he worriedly thought to himself. First, all of those Secret Service agents get killed, then the Special Ops team, and now this. This is getting way out of hand. It has to end.
2 hours later, Stargazer sat in his study facing Senators Rolander and Snyder. Once the doors had been closed by Stargazer's bodyguards and it was safe to talk, Rolander began.
I don't think calling this meeting was such a good idea.
Oh, you don't? Replied Stargazer, anger notching his voice up as he spoke.
Well, guess what? I'm done listening to you. This is all totally out of control.
Keep your voice down, snapped Snyder. Now, just tell us what's got you so worked up.
What's got me so worked up? I received a note today, along with the president's finger, he said, ignoring Snyder's request that he lower his voice.
Rolander was speechless.
I am not going to tell you again. Calm down. What did the note say?
The kidnappers want $50 million deposited to an account in Buenos Aires, or the next package I receive will contain President Rutledge's head.
Our friends are getting a little greedy, said Snyder.
They can't do this, said Rolander.
They are doing it, replied Snyder, who turned back to Vice President Marshfield. Are you sure it was Rutledge's finger?
Positive. It had a funny half-moon-shaped scar at the knuckle, which he always bragged about getting in a sailing accident.
What did you do with the finger?
What did I do with it? What do you think I did with it? I gave it to the Secret Service.
Jesus. What about the note? You didn't show anyone the goddamn note, did you?
The note? Of course I did. You expect me to keep this to myself? This is all so insane. You have to stop this, cried Stargazer,
the hysteria creeping back into his voice.
I never agreed to all of this killing. And what's more, our deal was that the president be returned safely to his office.
Marshfield was stepping on Snyder's last nerve.
Don't tell me what our deal was. I put it together, remember? You get your big fat war chest filled with untraceable campaign contributions and a chance to prove that you're made of the right stuff to be president. You stand tough and don't negotiate with terrorists and come out smelling like a rose. We know Rutledge doesn't plan on running for a second term, so you sail right into the number one position in the world. We handed you exactly what you wanted, so don't start telling me what our deal was.
I damn well will tell you, because your whole operation is falling apart, shot Marshfield.
The only thing falling apart here, Mr. Vice President, is you.
Me? You don't even have enough fingers and toes to count all the dead bodies on. And from what I hear, you let that Secret Service agent Harvath slip right through your grasp.
I'm not going to tell you again. You do your job, and we'll do ours. All you have to do is talk tough to the cameras and make sure the president's coalition for that fossil fuel reduction bill completely collapses. We want every yes vote so solidly no that even if he walked back onto the floor tomorrow morning, there'd be no resurrecting it. Do you understand me? The rest you leave to us. And for God's sake, man, pull yourself together. You certainly don't look like presidential material to me.
I know. The pressure is just...
Marshfield, I'm going to say this once. I know you're a smart man, and I won't have to say it more than that.